So, hello everybody. I'm delighted to have a very special guest with me today. His name is Jerry Burgos. Jerry and I met discussing personal finance. I think we talked about my company's Maxify Planner software, and I started asking him some questions about what he's up to and learned about his fascinating career in mining. And I've decided that some of what Economics Matters should be covering in terms of our podcast is the actual economy, not just what pundits think about the is going to happen interest rates or the stock market or studying Lincoln's financing of the Civil War, which we've done, or Martin Wolf, who's a top economics correspondent for the FT, what he thinks about world geopolitics. So we've had all these terrifically interesting people, including Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky on twice, people discussing Ukraine. We'll surely have another commentary about what's going on in Israel and Gaza. But I've started to pivot a little bit to discuss particular segments of the economy. So I had a podcast recently on the economics of the film industry. I'm going to shortly do one on the economics of the restaurant industry. Today, we're going to talk about mining economics, not necessarily economics of all mining companies, because I don't know if Jerry has that full enough background, but he certainly has a strong background in mining. And it's not that Jerry is a former head of, was it Glencore, is one of the major mining companies, I think, operating in 35 countries around the world. But he has been running over the years a small mining company. I'm going to tell you very quickly how he got into that, and then he's sold that, and now he's into a different interesting area of mining, which he's going to tell us about. I'm going to let him tell us about that. But anyway, Jerry is living out, if I got this right, Jerry, in Utah. He grew up in Long Island, went to Rutgers, studied geology. So this gives you, one of the things we're trying to get across here for younger people is that if you take a path that may be a little bit unusual, not everybody studies geology, it may lead to some very interesting career opportunities that are unexpected. So anyway, Jerry graduated in geology. He didn't go into some other field after graduating. He stuck with the field of that he majored in, and then he worked as a geologist in Louisiana, in Alaska, and Wyoming. He worked as a contract well site geologist. He'll have to explain to us what that means. Then he moved to Nevada, works at Nevada Test Site in support of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Then he starts working for ARCO, Chevron, BP, and Amoco Properties and their gas and oil reservoir development. So all this time he's learning about different aspects of the industry, geology and mining and exploration. And then he starts his own geological analysis lab in 89. And he was had different clients, including the New Zealand National Oil Company, Intermountain West Exploration, ARCO, BP. And then in 94, he started examining different business opportunities. And he went into hazardous waste isolation projects and mining claims in the West to mine pure glass sands. That's also called industrial quartz, which is an industrial mineral. And the use of that stuff at the time was to make beer bottles for cores and silicon computer chip manufacturers. So this brilliant idea basically dried up in around 2001 when three of his major clients took off, and so he had to figure out how to deal with a company that he had started that had nothing to do or little to do. So it just turned out that things were that at this point in time there was a need for sandboxes that you would have for children that weren't producing dust, dustless sandboxes. And Jerry realized that the sand he was excavating could be used for this purpose, and off he was running to produce sand for sandboxes. Now, that's, and so by 2002, he was not just a full-time mining geologist, but also marketing a company's products. And a lot of this started at a very low, you know, a low level, getting one excavator and filling up trucks by shoveling sand into trucks and then taking them to local purchasers. So he did this for 29 years. He grew his company, he sold his company to his employees, and then he went into semi-retirement. And now he is back into prospecting, mining prospecting, and he's going to tell us what that's all about. But welcome, Jerry. Let me ask you right off the bat whether I did justice to your background.
That was an excellent job, Larry. Good summary.
Great to see you. It's nice to have people connected to reality. You know, economists, we live in our kind of ivory towers, and don't get to talk that much to people that are actually making the economy work. And you've succeeded in that area. So give us a, well, tell us your the secret of what you're working on now, and then we'll go back in time and talk
about the company. The secret of what I'm working on now?
Yeah.
Well, you know, after I got out of the sand mining business, I decided that I could do geology, you know, real geology again, rather than doing marketing. And so I got into this. I don't know if you can see this. I'll hold it up to the screen. Gold.
Yeah.
I don't know gold. How good that's showing up, but
little pieces of gold.
Yeah, yeah, and gold prospecting. So, you know, if you think about the West, I live in Utah. If you think about the surrounding states, next to us is Nevada, it's the Silver State, California, the Golden State, Montana, the Treasure State, Arizona, the Grand Canyon State. So we have Utah's the Beehive State, but that has more to do with the local LDS religion. But even here, Abraham Lincoln called Utah the treasure house of the nation. So we've got a lot of natural, you know, materials here, a lot of natural resources. And because the price of gold has been going up so dramatically, you know, in this past, you know, year or two, I decided, well, you know, that's a fun hobby to get back into. And I lucked out. It's been a number of years ago. You can see, I don't know if you see this map. This is a map case and a bunch of maps over here and stuff like that. I had the opportunity to acquire the collection of maps from an old geologist who was, you know, I don't want to use the word treasure hunter because he was a geologist. He worked at all the big mining companies and just a wealth of information. And so, you know, that's what a lot of geology is digging through the old records and reports and the geological records.
This geologist is many, like a century old, we're talking?
No. He started his career probably in the mid-60s.
Okay.
Mid-50s. And so he was active from the mid-50s until he passed away around 2010.
And he started drawing maps and writing.
Voluminous amounts of maps. You know, I'll just turn the screen a little bit. You see this one hanging on the wall? I mean, yeah. These things were almost works of art. You know, it was done before computer graphics and computers. So everything was done by hand. Everything was colored by hand. I don't know if you can see the one down here, you know. So, yeah, real amount of detail. And so, you know, he worked for a company that was in the gold mine. He worked for companies that were in a lot of different businesses, but they searched for gold, silver, lead, zinc, and copper. That was another big one.
And so you knew about this gentleman, and he passed away, and then you acquired all his collection, and you're prospecting at your desk. You're not with a pail with a, you know, sifting through the water and seeing if you
no,
come
I,
up.
Actually, I have three pails right here filled with dirt that came from a prospect.
So,
But you are right. I am doing mostly my work at the drafting table right now, analyzing these old sites.
and what, so, what is going to kind of clue you in? What are you looking for as your prospect here? You're trying to find something that he said might be a possibility or might be a high probability, but nobody's going after. Is that the basic idea here?
It is partially. I'll back up one step before I answer your question, and that is that there's two basic types of gold deposits. There's the ones that you think of the California Gold Rush. Those are the guys who are out there with their gold pans, and those are deposits that are just flowing down the hillside into a stream, and you collect them that way. The other big guys are the ones typically going after underground gold mines, you know, where they have the tunnels and they're digging, or big open pit mines. That's the big guys. So those are two distinct different types of miners, and I fall into the gap. Oh, sorry. Oh, the Zoom just struck. I saw the balloons go by.
Yeah, we've been having all kinds of, the Zoom has been doing lots of crazy things on these different buckets.
Oh,
Not to
I'm
worry
sorry.
about it. It won't sound
Okay, I'll try not
complicated.
to hold my hands up. That's funny. So yeah, I go after what they call the placer deposits. That's the stuff that's in stream beds and hillsides that we can dig out with a shovel. But the mining companies, you know, they're going after the big stuff. To answer your question, why I started doing it. Well, when he prepared all of these maps and analyzed all of these soils and sediments, gold was $35 an ounce. That was back in, you know, the 50s. The government kept the price at $35 from 1931 until about 1969, until Nixon took us off the gold standard. So all of this information is based on $35 an ounce gold. And now, when I checked it, you know, Friday's close, it was over like 2200 and over 2200 bucks an ounce. So it changes the dynamics of the deposit when you have that much of a run up in price. And, you know, hopefully I can capitalize on that.
So, okay, but to this point, you're looking for, you know, when you study his maps, and I take it there's lots of these maps, is he saying gold mine, gold here?
Oh
Is
yeah, exactly.
he
Yeah,
saying
yeah.
this
Yeah.
is a place with gold? And then you are just looking at whether anybody's actually looked in that area.
That's correct. You know, now I'll bet if I had to put a number on it, I would say 80, 90, maybe even 95% of these places that are in these maps and things like that have been probably had a mining claim put on them at some point in time. Because, you know, prospectors were really thorough. Geologists are really thorough over all these years. And so they've probably been out there and they've looked at it and said, oh, it's, you know, too much overburden or too, you know, too much excavation work. We're not going to bother. And so that's, you have to look at it though from the economic standpoint of the prices today.
Right. Now, when you say putting on a mining claim, let's say you found an area that you thought nobody else had, or you checked and nobody else had claimed. What does this exactly mean? Do you go to the local town and say, I mean, what if it's somebody's yard?
Right.
What does this work
Well,
exactly?
you know, in this day and age, I sometimes wish there were more people that had yards with, you know, with minerals in them, because dealing with a private landowner is so much easier than having to deal with the federal government now. And so a mining claim typically is either on private land, state land, or on federal land. Now, unlike, you know, you live in the East and I grew up in the East. The federal government out here in the West owns about, this is a rough number, three quarters of all of our lands are all either federally controlled or even higher if you throw in the state control. And so you're going to the Bureau of Land Management, which is part of the Department of Interior, and you're saying, hey, I want to put up, I found something on here. I'm interested in putting a mining claim. And then you'd have to start going through all the hoops, but it's relatively easy to get the mining claim. It's harder if you want to start, if you're doing small scale stuff, it's easy. If you're doing big scale stuff, then it's a lot more difficult with environmental studies and things like that.
Let's talk about retirement for a minute. It's something Americans think about regularly. Ask yourself, how financially secure do you really feel? Do you have enough money to retire? How much is really enough? And if you don't have enough money, how can you possibly find that extra money before you do retire? These are all tough questions. My retirement software, Maxify Planner, is the powerful online planning tool that takes the guesswork out of retirement. It weighs your assets against your fixed expenses to calculate how much you can safely spend every year for the rest of your life based on when you decide to retire. And it shows you safe ways to find more money. Maxify makes a complicated problem like retirement planning simple. It's accurate, easy to use, and produces what you really seek, peace of mind. So make the smart choice and visit Maxify.com today. Don't miss this opportunity. That's Maxify with an I, Maxify. Maxify.com. Now let's get back to the podcast. And so for small scale, you said, these 5 acres I'd like to explore, and you then pay them some money, and then you have the right for like 5 years or something to dig, and then you have to, if when you leave, you have to put everything back the way it was. Is that the what happens?
Yes, that's correct. A lot of times, most of the time, you have to post what they call a remediation bond, which is like an insurance, but you buy an insurance policy that says I'll return it to, a state that the BLM geologists are happy with. Or if I don't do it, then they'll invoke the policy and they'll take the bond and they'll do it themselves. So you try not to do that. You always want to, remediate it to the best of make it look like you never knew it was there.
Okay. So, you haven't, once you do find something, you're then going to, how long will the process take before you can get, let's say, the right to actually start digging?
Each state, Bureau of Land Management is a little bit different in terms of the way they approach things. I'll give you the range. Down in Arizona, there's a lot of mining that's going on, and a lot of gold mining that's going on by little guys. And so down there, in 6 months, mo maybe the most, 9 months, you can go ahead and get your plan of operation approved. And that's pretty quick. In the old days, I could get a plan of operation. When I got my first industrial quartz mining claim, it took like 2, 3 months. Now, we had to do an archaeological study, we had to do an environmental study and things like that, but the bar to jump over was really low, and the bar has gotten much higher nowadays. On the other hand, I tried to get a mining claim. I don't You'll have to look up Moab, but it's a town in southeast Utah. They put me off for over 2 years before, they would even entertain it. And then after that, they said, "Oh, well, you have to do all these other things, like you got to go out and do a mineral study," and that was going to be $50,000, and so that made the bar just too high for that sort of thing. My first mining claim, all told, cost at about 1,500 bucks.
So you have to put in these claims and go through all this paperwork and everything before you can actually go and start digging. You can't actually, you have to, this is all speculation. You've got to put out whatever it is, $1,500, $50,000. I'm not talking about you, but whoever does this, they have to put out a chunk of money before they can even put a shovel in the ground. Is that true?
Well, the way it works is you have 90 days to file your claim. So that means I could go out there on weekends or, however much free time I had before that and go out and scout the land, maybe take a couple of test samples and things like that to see if the geology looked good. And then if it looked encouraging and I wanted to take the risk, then I would go ahead and file a mining claim. I'd put my, it's the old days. Put a pile of rocks or a big 4 foot stick on all corners of the property, and you write a piece of paper and you stick it in there, and then you go to the BLM and you file the paperwork and you file it with the county, and you have 90 days to do that. And it's a little bit like, the old days, the old West.
Wow, cool. And Do you have to have like some guns to keep other people off? They see you're kind of tracking you.
Probably
Jerry
not a good
again, let's
idea.
go after, follow him.
Yeah, I've never had that issue, before. And so, but I, again, you have to remember, I'm a small miner. And so, the buddies that I know that go out and they do this on the weekends, they may come back with, if they have a really good day and there's a couple of guys out there digging, they may come back with a half ounce of gold. Or maybe even if it's incredible day, a weekend, a whole ounce of gold. And it's hard work. And so, you don't typically you never see anybody because you're out in the middle of nowhere.
So an ounce of gold, again, you said, how much is that worth today? 20?
The close on Friday was $2,248,
So
2,200 bucks an ounce, an ounce, an ounce.
a good day is a good day. Yeah, that's.
But it's hard work. I mean, you're moving a lot of dirt, to find that. You might be digging up, a couple of tons of dirt, running it through the screener to get out the rocks and all the stuff that doesn't count, and boiling it down to just the good stuff.
So you actually go out there onto federal land or state land with some kind of a heavy machinery, if you're
Nope. No.
or no machinery.
No machinery. This is all, again, as a small miner, and maybe I should even call it a hobbyist rather than a small miner, because a small miner would go out there with machinery. But as a hobbyist, you're just going out with a small piece of of equipment. It's a screen that weighs maybe, 20 pounds, and you're screening the dirt that you shovel into it. Or if you or a sluice box where you have a stream and you're just running the dirt through the sluice box that's in the stream. Those are more advanced versions of panning for gold.
So this is like the old days, except a little better technology. I got it.
Exactly.
And if you make a bit of a, but you're supposed to fill up your hole after you're done, the end of the day, right? You don't leave a bunch of.
No, and these aren't big holes. I mean, I'll use an analogy of a sandbox, okay? A sandbox, because I think I used to think in terms of sandboxes. A sandbox that's 10 feet by 10 feet, that's a foot deep, is 5 tons of sand or dirt. Okay. So 10 by 10 by 1 foot deep is 5 tons.
That's a lot, huh?
Because dirt's heavy. And so the amount of area that you're disturbing is really quite small. And by the time you get done digging that amount of dirt,
You're
you're pretty
tired.
much done for the day. You're tired, and all of the material that you're screening goes right back into that hole. So,
And
it's kind of.
how deep would the mine, if we're talking about gold, is there any reason why it's on this closer to the surface than way down deep?
No, that's unusual that it's close to the surface. I mean, and I don't know the number, but I would say that's probably, of all the gold ever found, probably 95%, or who knows, maybe it's even 98% has been, deep gold. The stuff that you think about what they had in the gold rush of 1849, that was stuff that was on the hillside that had weathered out of veins of material and had just washed down the side of the hill. So that's a fraction of it, but it's still present.
And the biggest gold mines today are these still in Africa, or where are they?
Actually, that's a great question because again, I'm in Utah, and if you go 4 hours from west of Salt Lake to the town of Elko, Elko, Nevada, it's northern Nevada, for the past 30 years, it has been almost right close, if not always number one, certainly number two, but most of the time number one gold producing region in the world.
Oh.
Yeah, and they have just an exceptional deposit out there. It's not the type of gold that anybody would think of. It's invisible gold, actually. You could look, prospectors have looked at those rocks for years, 125 years. They never saw the gold because it was so small. It was, within the matrix of the rock. And then it took a couple of US Geological Survey guys to figure it out that it was actually microscopic in size. And now that it's called Carlin, Carlin. It's Carlin, Nevada. That's the name of the type of gold deposit. It's just invisible gold in the rock. And they've produced, the last time I checked, they were up over 200 million ounces of gold in the last, 40 years. And they're producing now they're still producing 5 million ounces a year for the last 30 years.
Well,
And so these are open pit mines.
and so they're just taking this, they're extracting this stuff, and then they're somehow chemically processing it to,
To extract it.
and then they make gold bars at the end. Is that the and then the bars are then just how much of this stuff is going into actual use for dental work or jewelry versus just held in reserves as kind of like cryptocurrency, kind
You know, the
store value.
US Geological Survey publishes that number, and I don't recall it. I haven't looked at it in a long time, but it's pretty minuscule. I would think it's on the order of 5 or 10% of all the gold. Most everything else gold, and that might even include jewelry too. There's a lot of cultures that prize that gold jewelry. So the majority goes to currency reserves and things like that.
Want more money, less risk, and a better life? Buy Money Magic, a new book by Lawrence Kotlikoff, Boston University economist, personal finance expert, and best-selling author. Whether it's education, career, marriage, housing, investing, retirement, Social Security, IRA, or 401k decisions, Money Magic delivers scores of secrets to raise your living standard. Financial journalist Jane Bryant Quinn says Money Magic is a must-read. Nobel laureate George Akerlof says Money Magic is quite probably the best financial advice book ever written. Financial guru John Maldon says, you'll love this amazing book. It's full of wit, wisdom, and startling paths to a better financial life. And columnist Scott Burns calls Money Magic a funny, brilliant read, offering wildly powerful, unconventional choices that can literally change your life. Get Lawrence Kotlikoff's Money Magic today at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and independent booksellers.
So this is really... we let's suppose there was no use for the gold at all, except as a store of value, and it's got value to the world because it's in limited supply, and even obviously there are new prospects coming along, but nobody thinks that there's going to be a enormous find, but where we can. Or if we could, let's say, counterfeit gold so that it was indistinguishable from actual gold, that whole market would go to peanuts, to not, And this is why Bitcoin has value, because it was set up in a way to limit its supply, but the valuation of Bitcoin is much more volatile than of gold, perhaps because gold has a longer history. And because central banks have held on to it. Now, central banks are talking about making their own cryptocurrencies, but and they could produce an unlimited really number. Anybody really could produce another Bitcoin. There are different, there's nothing special about its technology for limiting the supply. But so are you a investor in Bitcoin? Do you see an analogy here? And have you invested in
I don't see the analogy. And being in the geology business, where we deal with metals and solid things, stuff like gold and silver and tungsten and just mineral real what I call real minerals, are what I would be I put my money in.
Good to be able to see what you've got, in some sense, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like holding these little bags that have the little nuggets and things in them. It has a totally different feel rather than looking at my statement, that has Bitcoin
These are good birthday presents,
in
for sure.
it.
So tell me about, when you started your business, was it just you and another person? And did you, I mean, when you, how did you realize that you had sandless sand, I mean, sorry,
Dustless.
dustless sand, and then nobody else did. How did that, and that was what was needed? How did that all come together in your mind?
Well, it was serendipity. I did have a geology as a partner, business partner, and we were out exploring. We brought home, when you go out exploring and prospecting, you're looking at all kinds of things. Here in Utah, we have a lot of dinosaur bone pieces. We're almost literally Jurassic Park. And so you can't go in the field and not find petrified wood or maybe a piece of dinosaur bone if you're in the right location. And we came across this beautiful sand dune out in the desert. And we went, wow, this stuff is really nice. And as we geologists do, we took a 5 gallon bucket back to the house. And at that time, my kids were little, and they were like, 3 and 5, and they were like, "Well, the dinosaur bone looks like a rock. So what's in the bucket?" And I said, "Well, this really cool red sand." And they said, "What are you gonna do with it?" I said, "I don't know." So we dumped it out on a tarp, and within, probably an hour, there was half a dozen neighbor kids. Everybody just kind of, was drawn to it by a magnet, like a magnet, and they were playing in the sand and having a great time. And in the days afterwards, my neighbor parents would be like, "Hey, can you get us some of that cool red sand that you had?" And for our sandbox. And so we're like, "Well, we could probably get a mining claim on it." And that's what we did. So it was kind of, lucky in that respect.
And you could tell right away that it was dustless, that it.
We didn't realize that prop. I mean, we knew it was dustless, but we didn't realize the marketing value of that until later in the year. We actually took it. They had a thing called the Kids Fair, and there was like 30,000 kids and 10,000 parents. And this is back in, like probably 1994. Yeah, 94. And everybody converged on the local, convention center. All these, 40,000 people, kids, and we all had booths set up, Microsoft with their video games, and just everybody had something set up, and we had a 10 by 10 sandbox. And then the attendees got to vote what was the most fun activity. And even though there was climbing walls and obstacle courses and you name it, our sand won. Our sand won the award for the best product at that show. And we're like, "Wow, that's cool." We didn't expect quite that, but that level of award, but it happened. And one of the things that people said was they loved how clean it was. There was no dust in the sand. The kids would play, they'd get out of it, and they'd be as clean as when they got into it. And we were like, "Oh, wow." Because if you go to a home improvement store, they sell a real dirty, dusty sand, and ours was incredibly clean. So we were
Plus it
like, "Oh,
doesn't.
okay."
Plus, it doesn't get into your eyes, and that presumably the dust.
Right. And it doesn't aggravate your allergies and things like that. So turned out it was really great until, we thought, "Oh, it's a great idea. Two geologists got this mining claim and we got this great sand." And so we took it to the big box stores. And I remember the reaction from the big home improvement buyer. He goes, "Your wholesale price is more than my retail price for that same 50-pound bag of sand." He says, "Nobody's going to spend that kind of money on a bag of dirt." And basically he was like, "Get out of here." And so we're like, "Okay, so our plans to go big aren't going to happen, unless we want to lower the price." We tried to play that game for a while, but we lost our shirts, as I mentioned to you in some notes I sent you. And yeah, we lost our shirts, and after a year or two, he was ready to bail out. And I felt like it had potential. So, I bought out his share, and that was about 1998, and doing it ever since.
And then, okay, so here you find that a low price isn't going to work. You buy out a share. You're kind of basically in a pretty risky position. How do you then get customers? What do you do? What's the next part of the story?
a lot of legwork. I spent time looking at the market because I had lost my money too, in that year, 2 years that we were trying to promote it through the big companies. And so I looked at the marketplace and discovered that almost every elementary school in the United States in the kindergarten classroom has what they call a sand and water table. And the sand and water table holds 50 pounds of sand on one side and a couple of gallons of water on the other. And the kindergartens sit there and they mix it and play with it. And we had heard about the smoke alarms in the classrooms being triggered by the dusty sand. The kids would grab it, throw it up in the air, and it would set off the smoke detectors. And so when we heard that, we were like, well, hey, we got this dustless sand. And people started buying it, elementary, school districts started buying it for their elementary schools. And there's like 50 or 60,000 elementary schools in the United States. And so that was, the market. But to tap into it, we had to go to a lot of trade shows, where childcare centers and daycare centers and school districts went to. So that was a couple of year effort.
And did the box stores ever come back around or not really?
They did. Once they realized, how we were doing, they did come back around, some of them. But they still wanted, they were willing to accept the idea that the concept that, oh, you could sell a pure sand at a premium price. They were willing to accept that, but they still wanted, good discounting. Sometimes they wanted exclusives. And, it's like, you hang your hat on one peg, and if that peg breaks, you're screwed. And so we said, no, we're not going to do that. And we turned them down because at that point, e-commerce was starting to come on. And we, I realized at that point, hey, we have the opportunity not only to sell to school districts and things like that, Head Start programs, but we can do it to the individual consumer on our website. And that helped tremendously too.
And then I guess you're dealing with something pretty heavy to ship, right?
Oh, yeah, terribly heavy. Yeah, we were shipping 25 and 50 pound boxes all over the United States, and for a while, to different countries outside the US. And so, yeah, our shipping bill was appreciable. And UPS, United Parcel Service, was great for a number of years. They had a discount rate if you sent four heavy boxes to the same location, which we were doing a lot of. But then they started raising their prices. And fortunately, the US Postal Service came to the rescue. They came out with, they used to have the advertisements on TV for flat rate priority mail. If it fits, it ships. And so we found that we could fit 50 and 25 pounds of sand in those boxes, and we taped the heck out of them so they wouldn't bust open. And the Postal Service, I can't say enough. Everybody gets on their case about being snail mail, but they are exceptional in what they do, and the speed that they were doing it and the reliability was off the scale compared to what we had gotten with the previous shippers. So we actually solved that problem. We were lucky to solve that problem because USPS came out with flat rate shipping.
So you had this 22-year run, right, with this company. And how come nobody else comes in and says, well, I'm going to stake a claim right next door to Jerry's claim and, just do it at a much bigger scale and I'll compete them. Why, or did that happen? Did you have face competition after a bit?
We did. Once after about 10 years, people started realizing that, hey, I have beautiful beach sand, in my state. The Bahamas has beautiful coral pink sand. And so, yeah, competitors started showing up. And, and now there's probably, I can think of at least, two. Nobody opened up a mine or got a mining claim near us because, you have to do a lot of legwork and a lot of geology field work, driving up and down roads and finding out where the material is, and then can you get a mining claim on it? Then can you get the permits for it? And then do you want to risk going into production? Because most people don't think of play sand as a big business, but it's
Production here was just digging up the sand pile, right? Just
What's that?
production here is just getting some kind of a front loader and
Right, front loader. Yep, putting it, scooping it up with the front loader, dumping it into the trucks. The trucks would hold 80,000 pounds of sand at a time. And so we would fill those, and then we would haul it to the warehouse and what we call the sand yard, and we would just process it by hand to screen out scorpions, occasional piece of sagebrush that might get in there, and directly into the bag. So, from a mining standpoint, miners and geologists always think about, okay, we got a piece of land. How much of it is dirt and how much of it is ore? Because the ore is what counts, right? That's where the minerals are. Well, in the case of what we were mining, it was all not only ore, but it was the product. So, 99.9% of what we were able to mine was just the pure material. So it was fabulous.
And
All
how many?
pro profit.
So at this point, once you're, at the peak, how many trucks do you have? How many people do you have working for you? This is a big process, right? I mean.
Well, it isn't, but it's seasonal because you need to work when the weather's good. Out here in the western US, our hot season runs from June until the rain. Well, the rains start in August, but you can work around those. So from June until the end of September, maybe if you're lucky, mid-October, because you got to be out there when it's dry. And that posed a problem because it was, we're out in the desert, doing this mining, and it's got to be dry. So what I found out was that I needed a warehouse where I could keep the material under cover so it wouldn't get wet, so that during the winter time we could process it indoors and then fulfill our orders. And it turned out that a lot of the contracts we had with different companies that were buying it required us to have a year's supply already in stock in an inventory. And so that was always my target, to have that as a cushion.
Okay, so how many employees and how many trucks?
Right. So probably at the peak, six people doing the mining and the bagging, and then myself and person in the front office handling the invoicing and the billing, one person doing the website. That wasn't a full-time job, but still it was somebody had to do that. And
You
so
have one truck or five trucks or how many trucks?
at its peak we would do maybe three trucks at once, so that's 250,000 pounds of sand. That's a
Well,
quarter million
yeah,
pounds.
some kind of front loaders or track, some kind
Right. Right. But
of.
actually, we had one mining claim where you weren't allowed to use any kind of mechanical. You were allowed to use a truck if you wanted it, but trying to shovel, and we had to shovel by hand. So throwing it up into one of these big trucks was just not doable. So we would go out there with trucks that could carry 15,000 pounds at a time, and we would load those by shovel because the environmental operating regulations said we couldn't. It was antelope spawning season, so you can't disturb the antelope with mechanical equipment, so we had to use shovels, and it was always in the summertime, when the babies are growing up and getting strong and stuff like that. So it there's some locations that pose the challenge for sure.
Plus, it's super, super hot, right? I mean, at this
Oh
point.
yeah. Well, hey, if you need a job, you want to get out of the academic tower, and come out to the desert where it's 100, 105 degrees, and bag 25 and 50 pound bags of sand, come on out. We have openings.
I
It's a
see.
great deal.
I'd like to talk to you about a really powerful financial planning tool to help you make smart retirement and other critical financial decisions. It's a tool that factors in all your financial data and shows you what you can sustainably spend every year for the rest of your life. That tool is my software company's Maxify Planner. It's incredibly powerful, it's accurate, and it's easy to use. Maxify takes the guesswork out of financial decisions at every stage of life. Its focus is on raising, de-risking, and sustaining your living standard. Maxify lets you run what-if scenarios to see how your finances will change in taking new jobs, buying a home, doing Roth conversions, retiring early, downsizing, investing more in the market, you name it. Knowing the impact of these decisions before you make them is the secret to making smarter decisions. And it's also the secret to what we all seek, which is financial peace of mind. So please, visit Maxify.com today to start planning. That's Maxify with an I, M-A-X-I-F-I.com, Maxify.com. Now let's get back to the podcast. Now, so what impresses me here is that this is, yes, you're a geologist. Yes, you've had a lot of experience, but there are kind of day jobs where you don't have to be out there actually, doing all this physical work and then having to do the marketing and having to bear all the risk and buy the equipment and have the equipment go down and get repaired, make sure your workers are not getting sunstroke, heat stroke. You got to keep an eye on them. So there are all these risks, even liability, because they could get hurt and truck would fall, run over them, whatever. And you're married and you've got a couple kids, right?
Right. Well, yeah, that actually is another story, but it's a stressor.
Yeah, there were just the risk, and then you fail, and then you keep at it. So, did you have like enough in reserve to know that you would not starve if things failed completely, or were you just taking a gamble? Were you like, were you like the original gold miner, going out to the gold rush, or the sand rush in this context?
Right.
I mean, are you a risk taker in general, or you just thought this was just too good an opportunity?
You know, if you're in the geology business, you have to be a risk taker because nothing is ever, assured, because you can't see most of the time what you're dealing with. You know, you're making your best measurements from the surface, trying to look into the earth. And so I'm actually very conservative in a fiscal sense. And I'm always reluctant to stick my neck out if I think it's too risky. So like in my case with the sand business, I tried to avoid debt. I had some resources, I had savings because I had, I had 20 years in the corporate world. So I had some savings to fall back on if, if there was a dry spell. But I wasn't going to risk that, that stash of savings. I wasn't going to get a second mortgage on my house. That's just against my principles to do that kind of stuff, to buy equipment. I could have bought the trucks. I could have bought the machinery to do it and things like that, but I ran an analysis of it and it was like, okay, if it doesn't pan out, then I'm left with all this expensive equipment and you really can't do anything with it because it's so specialized.
You rented the stuff.
I rented the big trucks and the big loaders.
So no car loans and no truck loans.
Nope.
Just rented, kind of cash in, cash out. Make
sure.
That's
exactly right.
And walk away if you need to.
Right.
Great risk mitigating. You're great economist underneath all.
Well, maybe I got part of that to thank you for because of, like your Maxify program and things like that. And I even had a laugh because you came out with a book, Money Magic, which I absolutely love. I thought it was a great book. And you talk about jobs that, pay off and risk taking and things like that. And, I've learned a lot from what you've written. So, tried to employ it.
Well, it's great to hear that. I was surprised in looking at the occupational index of the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that you can kind of just look there and in 2 seconds find that, hey, what you're doing, you could make a lot more, maybe 30% more in a town not too far away or maybe another state that where the cost of living was 30% less. And overnight, you could increase your living standard maybe be after tax by 40%, and it's just there for the taking. So that was but of course you need to have some training and some expertise, and you had it, and you took advantage of the opportunity, and you did take some risks, but they were considered risks. And but had you had that not panned out, using that pun, you had the wherewithal to figure out something else to work on, because your you're up for hard work, and you're up for learning what you're doing, and then making the decision. And that's a good, and it doesn't require a PhD in geology from MIT.
No.
To make a decent living, and it doesn't have to be that you're producing rare earth minerals. You could be producing sand, and there's a market out there for it. So keeping your eyes open and ears open for where you can make a buck. This is a tough time, particularly for younger people, because so much is being automated. I hear these ads about AI, automate, automate, automate. And, you know, when we have everything automated, who's going to buy anything, right? Who's going to buy the stuff that all this automation is producing? The whole thing can leave us worse off. And I've written a paper with some colleagues, co-authors, called Robots or Us, where you see this transition of the economy where initially there's this big boom in the tech center sector because they created this technology that can be used and replace people and substitute for capital in some ways or make it more efficient. And then over time, all that technology starts competing, is there, you know, and then even the tech center sector starts to suffer because you've already kind of developed the, if you like, you know, think about the big blue, that computer that was able to beat Kasparov to win.
Right, in chess, right.
The IBM computer. And Kasparov was the top chess player in the world. We don't talk about the top chess players in the world anymore because we have these computers. But Big Blue was developed years ago, beat Kasparov years ago. And since then, kind of the game's over. We don't need to have a better version of Big Blue to play against humans because that one is good enough. So now they, you know, on the side, they develop computer chess programs that play against other programs. So one computer is playing against another, if you like. But the computer used to be a really big machine physically, and now it's, you know, probably just the laptop and can run on the laptop. So what I'm getting at is that hiring the programmers to program this automation is no longer needed. You don't need to hire programmers to program another Big Blue because they put themselves out of business. The dead computer scientists have their knowledge in that machine that's being used to compete with new ones, new scientists. And that's what can then lead to this kind of cycle: good times for the tech industry and then for the workers, and then bad times. And right now, these, you know, this area of STEM, science and technology, engineering and mathematics, that those fields are being very well compensated, but that may not be the case 20, 30 years from now. We may have too many STEM graduates and too many of them competing with the innovations that are now embedded in AI, in technology. And what we may really need is more geologists out there panning for gold. So, Jerry, been a great pleasure. You've taught us a lot about mining, about real world mining, and about you know, being willing to pick up a shovel in 105 degree temperature with scorpions and probably rattlesnakes and make a living. So this is Economics Matters, the podcast, and this is about the economics of mining, and it's about the real world. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a great pleasure, Larry. Great meeting you. Bye.